Election College, episode 278, The Two Mrs. Wilsons.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
Ben, we keep on talking about, you'll hear more about that in our episode dealing with the wives of Woodrow Wilson. And here it is. And this is our last episode about Woodrow Wilson for a while, or people working directly with Woodrow Wilson, or in this case, being married, which might not be too much different than working in the situation. Woodrow Wilson's first wife, Ellen Axon, was born in May of 1860 in Savannah, Georgia. Now, she was the daughter of a preacher, a Presbyterian minister, and she was, you know, raised in this kind of Southern genteel way. She loved art and music and literature. So 1883 rolls around, and it was April, you know, spring, crazy things happen. And her buddy, Jesse Woodrow Wilson, who lived in Rome, Georgia, where Ellen was from, had a visitor come to his house. And that visitor was his cousin, Woodrow Wilson. And she meets him. She's keeping house for her dad, who is a widower. And Woodrow is like, wow, what splendid laughing eyes.
I guess he liked her.
That's what I said when I met my wife.
That's right. Well, they got engaged about 5 months later, and then they decided to postpone the wedding because he was doing some postgraduate work at Johns Hopkins, and she was taking care of her father, who was sick. Her father actually ended up committing suicide. He was hospitalized for depression and ended up taking his life. So later, she goes to study at the League of New York, the Art Students League of New York. And then she goes off and studies some portrait art and gets a medal, and she does a lot of cool stuff. And then she goes back to Georgia. And when they are, Wilson's 28 and she is 25, they get married in Savannah, Georgia at her grandparents' home. And of course, his father, being a reverend, being a pastor, they have him do the ceremony along with Ellen's grandfather. So they go off the honeymoon, of course, and at that point, Woodrow gets offered a teaching position at Bryn Mawr College for $1,500, and they move there, live near the campus, and her little brother moves in with them.
All the while heading north, Ellen is all about keeping the Southern culture, right? And part of what that involves is making sure your kids are born in the South. That doesn't exactly work out, because it takes a little while to go south just to have your baby. But anyway, the Wilsons had three daughters, Margaret, Jessie, and Eleanor. Kind of interesting, Ben. I got off on a huge rabbit trail about Margaret Wilson. Uh-huh. She cut a record that Columbia Records took, like in the 1913-ish, somewhere around there. So she was a singer. And then later in life, she moved to India and became a Hindu nun.
Oh, wow.
And that's where she died.
That's an interesting life for sure.
Isn't that, can you imagine? And then Jessie worked at a settlement house in Philadelphia. She married Francis B. Sayre at the White House, and they settled in Massachusetts, and she joined the faculty of Harvard Law School. So she didn't end up being a Southerner. And then Eleanor ended up marrying a future Secretary of the Treasury, William Gibbs McAdoo.
McAdoo's a cool last name.
It really is. We might just have to do an episode where we just say McAdoo.
Just the whole, it's the McAdoo episode.
Yeah. So, like I said, Margaret and Jessie, they were born in Georgia, but Eleanor, she's Yankee because they couldn't get there in time. The Southern family, the Wilsons, they move north, keep the Southern ideals, but no, they're going to hang out up east.
So after Woodrow gets elected as president in 1912, they pretty much decide that they're not going to have an inaugural ball. Ellen is really a lady of simple tastes, but she is hugely classy, very cordial to her friends and family and the guests she entertains, and the parties are still successful and people like them. She convinces her husband that maybe we need to invite some people who are influential over every now and then for private dinners and, you know, stuff like that. During the time where they're married, Woodrow, of course, having grown up in a slave-owning family and then being from the South, that is ingrained in them. But as the First Lady, Ellen is really devoting a lot of effort to improving different housing and things like that for the black slums in Washington, D.C. And so she would go to alleys that were run down and, you know, areas of town that were run down and bring them to the attention of the congressmen and everything to try to get some better living arrangements for the African-American population. In 1914, unfortunately, she passes away in August from Bright's disease, and she dies there at the White House. She gets buried in Rome, Georgia, and is buried there at Myrtle Hill Cemetery.
Yeah, what a shock, and how sad is that? Margaret, their daughter, ends up taking over the responsibilities as the White House hostess until, well, this isn't actually very long after Ellen passes away. A certain lady named Edith Galt is introduced to Woodrow Wilson, the president. So we're going to cut all the way back. We're going to go back to 1872 now. Edith Bowling was born in October of 1872 in Wytheville, Virginia. So another lady who is born to a prominent Southern family who held slaves. And yeah, her family, get this, she has a direct line to Pocahontas. She's related to Pocahontas. I think it's her and, so Edith Wilson and Nancy Reagan are related to Pocahontas. Can you believe that?
I didn't know that. I was clueless.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Edith is the seventh of, get this, 11 children. Two of them did pass away in infancy, but they were kind of an influential family. They were some of the oldest members of the different slaveholding families in Virginia, prior to the Civil War, of course. And then after the Civil War, her father turns to law. He goes into the practice of law to support his family. And, you know, later on, he's not able to really keep the plantation going. They weren't able to pay the taxes on all the different property that they had. And they moved to Wytheville, where most of the kids were born, just like Edith was. And so the house is it's a big house. Of course, like I said, 11 children, nine who were able to live past infancy. And not only did they have the kids, but Edith's grandmothers, a couple aunts, some cousins, all of them lived with Edith's family. And a lot of them were widowed because they had lost different husbands and family members during the Civil War. So there they are in the South, supporters of the Confederate States of America, proud Southern planters, and Edith is fully indoctrinated in the whole idea of the lost cause, you know, that the South propagated. So, yeah, justifying slave ownership, justifying the way of the South, and quite an interesting, extended, large family for sure.
Yeah, and what's really crazy about this is, okay, Edith has a couple of sisters who are enrolled in the local schools, but Edith wasn't enrolled because her grandma Bowling, was crippled by a spinal cord injury. And all the family got together, I'm sure, one day and said, hey, Edith could probably do a very good job of taking care of Grandma Bowling. Why not? And so that's exactly what happens. Edith washes her clothes, turns her bed at night, and looks after her 26 canaries. Yeah, so you can imagine what this is like. You've got your grandma who's confined to her bed with all these birds. It just seems like a little Willy Wonka.
I was just going to say that.
Action going on there. But anyway, Grandma Bowling is teaching Edith all about how to read and write and do all the things that Southern women would do. They spoke this hybrid language of French and English. I wonder if it's anything like what I used to speak when I took French and could never get beyond my Kentucky accent.
Probably not.
So, yeah, it was probably much better sounding.
A bit more refined.
I would think so. The family would get together and they would read classic English literature. Her dad did hire a tutor. Sometimes Edith would go along with her dad as he would travel around. And by the time she was 15 years old, she was enrolled in college at Martha Washington College. And she didn't always like school. She found some of the places she attended to be too regimented. Other places just didn't seem like the food was good and the rooms were too cold and things like that. So she finally did end up at Powell School for Girls in Richmond, Virginia. And later in life, Edith actually looked back on that and said, that was a great time in my life. But, you know, life happens. And the headmaster at that school got into an accident. He lost his leg over that. And William Bowling, Edith's dad, was like, nope, you need to come back home and let your brothers attend school instead. So there's Edith. She doesn't have the formal education. She's gone here and there. But she goes to Washington, D.C. To visit her sister. And then magic happens.
Yeah, she meets Norman Galt, who is a pretty well-known jeweler in the area. And they get married on April 30th of 1896. They live in Washington, D.C. for about the next 12 years. About 7 years after they get married, she has a son who only lives for a few days. And it was a pretty difficult childbirth and puts her in a position where she's no longer able to have more children. A few years later, Norman Galt unexpectedly dies at the age of 43. So basically she hires somebody to oversee all of his business, make sure his debts are paid off, and then she has some income left over because of the profession he was in, and she heads off and tours Europe. Now, in March of 1915, she gets introduced to Woodrow Wilson. At this point, he is a widower, and they both know Helen Woodrow Bones. Bones is Woodrow Wilson's first cousin and is also the hostess.
It's an awesome last name.
Also another awesome last name, Bones, for sure. And so Woodrow's like, I like this woman. She's pretty cool. I think I'm going to wait like a week or two and then propose. So there were some rumors that Woodrow had cheated on his first wife with Galt, and that was bad for them, but it was unsubstantiated, and it was a whole mess because, you know, not only did people say he cheated on her, but people say that she actually had her murdered, and this is just crazy because they hadn't even met until after the fact that she had already passed away. So Woodrow Wilson's like, hey, why don't you go ahead and back out of the engagement? It's no problem. And instead, Edith's like, nah, that's fine. I'll just wait till your wife has been gone for like a full year, and then we'll get married. So they did.
You know, this is where it gets kind of, I'm not going to say funny, but I just did say funny, so I guess I did. Ellen's experience as first lady to Woodrow Wilson was completely different than Edith's.
Yeah.
The big thing was the fact that World War I is about to break out in 1917, and the U.S. is entering into the war, I should say, in 1917. And Edith becomes the quintessential wartime spouse. And what I mean by quintessential is she starts these austere measures around the White House. She's like, we're going to have gasless Sundays and meatless Mondays and wheatless Wednesdays. And it takes off. You know, people are like, wow, the First Lady is showing that we can all cut back in order to support the war effort. And she becomes very involved in the administration. She does all she can do to keep him physically fit. You know, he's got this history of having strokes and other weird ailments that come. And she accompanies him when he travels to Europe for the peace conference. And what happens in October of 1919 is what you're going to hear most of all when you hear somebody say, First Lady Wilson. And that is, in October of 1919, Woodrow has a stroke. He's paralyzed on the left side, and not very many people know what's going on, because Edith takes over a whole bunch of things when it comes to running the government.
Yeah, that's true. And really, she takes on this role for quite some time. You know, he was still going to be in office for about a year and a half. And so she takes on the role of the First Lady slash, you know, making decisions for the executive branch. And she actually says, quote, "I studied every paper sent from different secretaries or senators and tried to digest and present in tabloid form the things that, despite my vigilance, had to go to the president. I myself never made a single decision regarding the disposition of public affairs. The only decision that was mine was what was important and what was not, and the very important decision of when to present matters to my husband," end quote. So really, you know, I think a lot of people didn't and maybe even don't believe this, because there were long periods of time where no one else saw the president except for his wife. Didn't really know what condition he was in, if he was even conscious at certain points. And so certainly it was needed for someone to be the gatekeeper while he was ill. And that's understandable. But at the same time, you know, get into this conversation of, well, whose duty is it to make sure that the president is the one doing his job and not somebody else? And yeah, really an interesting dilemma when you think about the fact that was somebody else totally running the president's job for a while? And if so, is that okay?
Yeah. At best, it's agenda setting, right?
Right.
And in my journalism classes in college, I can remember, you know, always hearing about agenda setting, where the news media doesn't necessarily make the news, but they set what you're going to see. So at best, that's all she was doing. She was setting the agenda. At worst, she was running the country,
right,
unelected.
And this is before women, I mean, they should have, of course, but this is before women actually had the right to vote. So not only were women not even allowed to vote at this time, they certainly weren't allowed to be president. Of course, you know, we know we're on the right side of history now, knowing that women should have been able to vote. But just really interesting to think of how much power she probably had, in the very least, at being able to present what was important to her and what was not to the president.
Yeah, you know, Ben, probably the more astonishing thing to me, and this is probably looking at it, you know, 100 years later, It's shocking that Wilson survives. Like, he lives to the end of his term.
Right.
Because everybody's just kind of thinking he's not going to make it.
Yeah.
And he does make it. And he makes it till, you know, several years after he's out of office. But what ends up happening is, okay, he makes it, and she tends to him for 3 years. They buy a house in Washington, D.C., and she goes and heads the Women's National Democratic Club, is involved in Washington, D.C. life right up until the end. In 1961, she attends the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. She was there when Franklin Roosevelt addressed Congress after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. On the day she died, she was supposed to have been the guest of honor at the dedication ceremony for the Woodrow Wilson Bridge there in Washington.
Yeah, pretty incredible. Passes away in 1961, and definitely saw a long span of different events in our country. I mean, a couple world wars for sure. Was born, of course, after the Civil War, but You can imagine the impact that those events had on her life directly, living so close to the events. So, yeah, a pretty incredible time period to be alive during. And then also, who knows what kind of decisions she was able to make. And, hey, maybe they were great decisions that were made too, or at least great things that she was able to make sure happened during that time where her husband was ill. But very interesting lady.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. You know, they were only married, what, 9 years? And they were only married a couple of years before she rose to such prominence. And, you know, she's buried next to him in the Washington National Cathedral. Ellen is buried in Georgia with her family. So, yeah, despite the fact that they were married a lot longer, Ellen kind of takes a back seat in the history when it comes to thinking of the Wilson ladies.
For sure. Hey, Jason, we have 3 new reviews I want to read. How's that sound?
That sounds awesome.
Cool.
Some of these titles are just spectacular.
Yeah. The first one's from Zany10, and it's just called Entertaining. It says, "You sure make learning fun. I've just started at the beginning and haven't caught up, but I love all of the nicknames for the historical figures." Well, we do too, and you'll hear this hopefully when you catch up, whatever that is. The next one is called Manifest Bestiny, and it's from someone called Millard Chilmore, which is phenomenal.
Spectacular.
Says, "I stumbled upon gold with this podcast. I take pride in being a weirdo who binge listens to presidential podcasts, and it didn't take me long to make it through the episodes once I started. From His Rotundity to Eugene Debs, Ben and Jason do a great job of entertaining listeners while providing great background and info on elections and important people. My favorite part is that they bring obscure historical figures out to the spotlight who deserve more attention. 5 stars all the way." Thank you very much, Millard Chilmore. We appreciate that. And the last one for this week that we'll read is from PGH Pickles, which I wonder, there's a Pittsburgh pickle company. I wonder if that's the same company. They also, my company distributes some things to their company. So anyway, it's called Learn and Laugh. "Easy listening and learning abounds at EC. The cousins have a delightful banter throughout each podcast. Keep it up." Thank you to all 3 of those reviews, and keep them coming. We want to make sure to read as many things as we can on the show.
Yeah, and if you haven't already, be sure to interact with us in our private Facebook group. You can go to electioncollege.com/group, and you will be ushered into the very presence of Ben and Jason. That's right. You can be there. You can hang out with us and a bunch of our buddies who enjoy talking presidential election history. Yeah, it's not one of those trivia groups. Not that there's anything wrong with those, but, you know, that kind of thing is all over.
That's right.
Facebook. We're just kind of like, who are the people who listen to the podcast and who are interested in this? And for those of you who didn't know, I'm selling just about every personal belonging and moving into an RV with my wife and 4-year-old, and we're going to be traveling around, and we're looking for things to do. So do let us know in the group where some places we can go and hang out and maybe even meet up with you and shake your hand or something.
Yeah, that'd be awesome to hear those stories for sure. Hey, if there's something you want to do that's not leaving a review, you've already done that maybe, and you want it to be really easy, if you're going to shop on Amazon, just go to electioncollege.com/Amazon, make all your purchases. You won't pay a penny more, but we'll get somewhere between 4% and 7% of everything you buy. That really helps us out a lot.
Hey, we'll see you over in the group, and be on the lookout because we got some other stuff to give away.
Bye.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.